Les colloques du Collège de France.
So our next speaker is James Briscoe from the Crick Institute in London. James is a developmental biologist and he will tell us about NeuroTube. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to visit Paris. What I wanted to do today is I wanted to discuss how we've been taking part a self-organizing developing system and trying to put it back together, and what we think this is beginning to reveal about sort of some fundamental logic about how tissues reliably generate cellular diversity. But let me take a step back. What I, fundamentalist developmental biologist, what I'm interested in is how you generate cell diversity and organization in developing tissues. And of course, this is particularly relevant in the developing central nervous system, where scores of molecularly and physiologically distinct cell types have to be precisely arranged to form functional neuronal circuits. And just to make this more concrete, we study this in the neural tube, the posterior region of the central nervous system that will give rise to the spinal cord. So this region, like the rest of the nervous system, starts off as a seemingly uniform sheet of cells, but it reliably generates the precise diversity of cell types it needs in the right positions, in the right proportions. And this is the first step in the construction of functional neural circuits. So you can see here in these images, this cross-section through a developing neural tube. It shows this beautiful spatial patterning where you have very reliable, precise domains of gene expression that divide the dorsal ventral axis into distinct, discrete groups of molecularly identifiable progenitors, which will go on to differentiate into post-mitotic neurons. So this arrangement depends on signals emanating from the ventral and dorsal poles, noticeably in the ventral region of the neural tube, which will form the motor circuits. The secreted protein Sonic Hedgehog is produced and is required for this arrangement of gene expression. And it does this by controlling the gene expression within progenitors, but those genes themselves act in the process of pattern formation. They encode for transcription factors, and those transcription factors form a transcriptional circuit, and the regulatory interactions between pairs of these transcription factors are important for specifying the pattern. So here you see what happens when you perturb that regulatory network. So you see, if we knock out a transcription factor, PAX6, not only do you lose PAX6 expression in progenitors, but you change the expression of that red transcription factor, NKX22. So this gene regulatory network, controlled by the patterning signals, is a central component of pattern formation. It converts that external signal into discrete domains of gene expression that underpins patterning. And those type of experiments, those genetic perturbation experiments over the years, has allowed us to reconstruct the transcriptional network. And you can see a couple of cartoons of that network in this slide. So you notice there's lots of regulatory interactions, particularly repressive interactions. And these are important for that generation of those discrete switches, the turning on and off of gene expression at particular positions along the dorsal ventral axis. And from the larger network, we can begin to extract out little sub-circuits and explore those in more detail in silico to understand really how these transcriptional networks operate. So we can go from the sort of the description of gene expression within the neural tube and regulated by external signals to transcriptional circuits, convert these into mathematical models which just describe mathematically those regulatory interactions and explore those in silico. And this has revealed a couple of important things. So for hedgehog signaling emanating from the ventral pole, in particular floor plate cells, it reveals that this, the logic of this regulatory network, the dynamics of that regulatory network are responsible for generating a response to both the level of hedgehog signaling and the duration of hedgehog signaling. So the transcriptional network is converting the amounts and duration of signal into discrete stripes of gene expression. So this begins to give us a logic and understanding of how you generate that pattern. And we can take that logic and explore that in vitro models. So now we can take embryonic stem cells, expose these to the same set of signals that they would see in the embryo to convert them into neural progenitors, then expose them to different amounts and durations of hedgehog signaling in vitro, and recapitulate that in vivo patterning in vitro. And here the key advantage is control. We can vary the inputs precisely, perturb genes cleanly, and make quantitative measurements across entire populations. So this gives us an in vitro model that we can now use to explore pattern formation in this system. But these models, both the in silico models, in vitro models, are telling us what happens when the tissue is already partially organized. It already has a source of the patterning signal. But a fundamental question remains, where does that initial symmetry breaking happen? How do you initiate this process to go from a uniform population of cells to some kind of asymmetry that allows the patterning process to start? And that's really what I want to focus on today. And this arises from a collaboration which has been led by Hannah Stewart in collaboration with Eli Tanaka in Vienna. And this starts, this involves a 3D preparation using embryonic stem cells that we've termed neural tube organoids. These start from a single pluripotent embryonic stem cell or a small aggregate of two, three pluripotent cells. If we allow these to grow in vitro with a time pulse of retinoic acid, it triggers a remarkable process of self-organization. So you can see on the left a single cell growing, we add a pulse of retinoic acid, and then within the period of about 5 days, we end up with a cyst of neural progenitor cells, which are patterned remarkably similar to the in vivo neural tube. We see a floor plate expressing hedgehog at one pole, and then those stripe of gene expressions arrayed away from that source of hedgehog signaling. So this mimics the in vivo neural tube with quite remarkable fidelity. So it provides a way for us to ask, what initiates this self-organization? How do we get symmetry breaking? How do we get the appropriate proportion of cells allocated to different cell types in the neural tube? So just to restate that in a cartoon form. So we start with a single ES cell or a small aggregate of ES cells, allow these to grow in vitro for a couple of days, then add a pulse of retinoic acid, usually for 18 hours. And that pulse of retinoic acid is essential to start this process. On removal of retinoic acid, we see that symmetry breaking event, which over the next 3 or 4 days resolves into a well-patterned neural tube organoid with a source, a polarized source of hedgehog and those stripes of gene expression arrayed away from that source of hedgehog. So this gives us a system where we can ask, what is the mechanism of symmetry breaking? How do we get the diversification and the proportions of cell types within that organoid? And then what results subsequently in the spatial organization? And today I'm going to focus on those first two aspects, so the symmetry breaking and the proportioning of cell types. So we can look at this at the molecular level. So we performed time-resolved single-cell RNA sequencing during this process of symmetry breaking and patterning, so sampling every 12 to 24 hours through to day six. And this is analysis undertaken by Jinkui Wang. And what you see in this UMAP projection is that retinoic acid pulse initiates a major transition in cell state from pluripotent to neural induction. Withdrawal of retinoic acid then initiates a second state transition, and the transcriptional landscape then bifurcates. One of the arms results in neural progenitors, the other results in floor plate cells, which are the source of hedgehog. And key markers that will become important for the rest of the talk is PAX6, which marks neural progenitors, and FOXA2, which marks the floor plate. So that pulse of retinoic acid is doing something fundamentally important. It's not just accelerating neural differentiation, it's also enabling this symmetry breaking, this generation of two distinct lineages from a single starting population. And if we zoom in on that key transition at day three, after retinoic acid withdrawal, we can see that, so before retinoic acid, these are pluripotent OPT4 expressing cells. What's striking, just after the withdrawal of retinoic acid, we see those two key transcription factors, PAX6 and FOXA2, being expressed, and many cells are simultaneously expressing both of those factors. By day four, this co-expression is largely resolved. So now most of the cells are either PAX6 positive or FOXA2 positive, and they're arranged in a salt and pepper-like fashion within these forming cysts. And by day six, they've sorted out into spatial domains with a single pole of sonic hedgehog expressing cells driving patterning in these neurotube organoids. So we wanted to really look at what's happening during this early step of co-expression that, and what drives the resolution into one fate or the other. So first of all, we can take the genetic approach. We can ask whether PAX6 and FOXA2 are not only useful markers for this process, are they actually involved in this process? So we can knock out one or the other and ask how cells perform in the absence of either PAX6 or FOXA2. And if we knock out FOXA2, now neural tubes completely lack floor plate. There's no sonic expression. Consequently, there's no patterning. There's no NKX2 or OLIG2 expression. They're still neural. They still differentiate into neural, but they're unpatterned. So FOXA2 is required for this symmetry breaking event. Conversely, in the PAX6 knockout, now neural tube organoids become almost entirely floor plate. So almost all of the cells in the organoids are FOXA2 positive, with only a few non-FOXA2 NKX2 expressing progenitors. So the knockouts fail in sort of exactly the opposite way. So this tells us that both FOXA2 and PAX6 are both individually necessary for proper neural tube formation, for patterning, and that they normally antagonize each other. When you remove one, the other takes over. What we can also do is then make neural tube organoids which are chimeric, so a mixture of FOXA2 negative cells and combined with some PAX6 negative cells. So these are now starting from aggregates of two or three cells, one of which would be a FOXA2 negative cell, another of which would be a PAX6 negative cell. And if we do that, we can rescue patterning, as you can see on this side here. And as you would expect in those circumstances, it's the PAX6 negative cells which become FOXA2 positive and vice versa. So as long as you have a mixture of cells which are able to express FOXA2 or PAX6, you can recover this process. So the conclusion here is that FOXA2 and PAX6 are necessary for neural tube organoid organization. But are they sufficient? Are they necessary? Are they sufficient as well as necessary? So to test this, Hannah generated two cell lines, one of which has inducible control of PAX6, the other of which has inducible control of FOXA2. Then again, we can mix these together to make chimeric neural tube organoids. And now instead of that pulse of retinoic acid, we can use doxycycline to transiently induce expression of PAG6 and FOXA2. And as you can see, the result of doing that is we can make chimeric organoids, some cells expressing FOXA2, some cells expressing PAG6, and they resolve as the wild type organoids do into a well-patterned neural tube organoid with a single pole of hedgehog expression and neural progenitors occupying the rest of the organoid. So they're sufficient. So when you make a chimera and induce a mixture of FOXA2 and PAG6, then that's sufficient to generate a well-patterned neural tube organoid. So we can reconstitute patterning with expression of these two proteins in separate cells. Okay, so given that we've established the symmetry breaking event and understand something, at least some of the control of that, we were interested in understanding what controls the proportions. So what determines the proportion of floor plate versus neural progenitors in these organoids. And what was striking is when we looked at organoids, we saw that on average about 25-27% of cells within an organoid became FOXA2 expressing floor plate precursors, whereas the rest were PAG6 positive neural progenitors. And that ratio is very reproducible. Across neural tube organoids, you can see there's a tight distribution here. So that distribution is plus or minus 5 percentage points. So how is that precision achieved? Is each cell making an independent decision, probabilistic decision, and it just happens to give us that tight distribution? Or is there some level of tissue-level feedback that coordinates this proportional allocation? So to answer this, we turned to some modeling and wanted to generate a dynamical modeling. And in particular, we wanted to look at this process, the whole process of transitions between these cell states, really focused on this decision here where after retinoic acid withdrawal, you generate this mixed population that then breaks symmetry to resolve into neural progenitors and floor plates. So I need to digress now for a couple of slides. We've already had a lot of introduction into dynamical systems theory, so you're already well primed for this, but I just want to get us all up to the same speed. So this again is building on the concept of a Waddington landscape, where we can think of cells as basins, craters, valleys within a landscape. But we wanted to make this sort of more mathematically precise and grounded in experimental data. So, as you know, we can view development of cells transitioning between specific states, think of those states as basins, as craters within some kind of landscape, and then cells flow through this landscape on the basis of the gradient, so they will fall to the bottom of a crater, of a basin of attraction. And you all know you've all seen maps, we all know that if you've got a three-dimensional landscape, we can represent that in two dimensions by drawing contour lines that connect places of similar height. And I just need to highlight two important points within these maps. So in red are what we call attractors, so these are the bottom of the basin, so this is the position that cells would roll to within that landscape. And then in green are what are known as saddles or saddle nodes. These represent the lowest points between two basins of attraction. So these are like the passes between in mountain ranges between the valleys. So we can represent a three-dimensional landscape as a map in two dimensions. And if we can do that, then we can describe that two-dimensional map with a mathematical equation. And all that mathematical equation is doing is mapping every point in XY, every point in the 2D plane, to a height in Z, so a height above the base level. Then if we have a mathematical equation describing that landscape, if we differentiate that equation, then that gives us the slope, the steepness of the gradient at every position within the landscape, so that describes how a ball rolling on the landscape will behave. And that just leads me to introduce you to one further concept, which are these red lines here. So in dynamical systems terminology, these are referred to as unstable manifolds, and they connect each of the green points, each of the saddles, to the adjacent red points, to the adjacent attractors. And they represent the steepest points between the saddles and the attractors. So if water was flowing down this, this is the route that water, the ball rolling down the landscape, would take. So now we have a way of describing these dynamical landscapes. And as we have mathematical equations that describe these landscapes, mathematical equations obviously depend on parameters. And if we change parameters of those equations, we change the landscape. So we can think of those parameters then as signals. If we change a signal, we change the value of the parameter, we change the landscape. So you can see an example of this here, where we've got an equation which describes a particular landscape. If we change this parameter here, we can see it changes the size, the depth of this particular attractor. So as we change it, that attractor, that basin gets shallower and shallower until it collides with its adjacent saddle. And that's, in dynamical systems terms, called a bifurcation. And it results in any cells being within that attractor being tipped into the adjacent basins. And there's a branch of dynamical systems theory actually pioneered, invented by René Thom, called catastrophe theory, which provides a library of polynomial equations which describe the simplest ways of describing characteristic normal forms, characteristic landscapes. And that will become important later. Good, so now you're all up to speed with dynamical systems theory. There will be a test at the end, don't worry. But now we can get back to experiments and data. So, okay, so with that basis in mind, we wanted to build a landscape to describe this process of symmetry breaking and allocation into those two cell types. And of course, to do that, we needed quantitative data. We wanted to look at the proportions of cells at different times in different states. And to do this, we took advantage of high-dimensional flow cytometry, so using five-dimensional intracellular FACS with a panel of antibodies that allows us to identify each of the cell states we were interested in. So this gives us single-cell resolution, quantitative data of the proportions of cells at every time point in each condition we're testing. So this beautifully recapitulates what I've just shown you. So at the start of the experiment, before retinoic acid exposure. This I'm just showing you here, two dimensions of PAX6 and FOXA2 dimensions, but we've got five dimensions simultaneously here. So prior to retinoic acid signaling there, PAX6 and FOXA2 negative. Exposure to retinoic acid results in the induction of PAX6. Then when you withdraw PAX6, you start to see that co-expression of FOXA2 and PAX6, which over the period of the next day or two, you can see resolves into either PAX6 positive cells, about 75% of them, and 25% are FOXA2 positive. So now we've got quantitative data looking at this process of symmetry breaking. So what we need now is, so here is the actual quantitative data. So you can see we can present this as the proportions of cells in each of the states over this time course. So what we needed now, of course, is a dynamical landscape to describe this. And we're particularly interested in this bottom half of the landscape here. So that's what I'm going to focus on. And we took advantage of catastrophe theory to model this. And the particular landscape topology we used is, I'm going to refer to as a binary flip or a heteroclinic flip. And this has the geometry we required. It has a head attractor, and that head attractor will correspond to the PAX6 FOXA2 co-expressing state. And this head attractor is then connected to two downstream states here labeled A and B, which will represent the neural progenitor or the floor plate. And what distinguishes the binary flip from simpler bifurcations is that cells can flow into either attractor depending on the unstable manifold. So this unstable manifold connected to this saddle node at the head attractor can connect either to one or the other downstream attractor. And depending on parameters, this will move, can be tilted from one attractor to the other. So this is actually an example of a global bifurcation. The one I introduced you to was a local bifurcation with an attractor hitting a node. Here we're not changing any of the attractors, but we're changing how the unstable manifold is situated within the landscape. So this is a mathematical structure that we use to describe this second half of this this process. And this here just demonstrates this feature of the heterokinetic flip, where depending on the parameters, that unstable manifold can flip from one attractor to the other attractor. And if there's some noise in this and the and you're close to a bifurcation, of course, cells will be allocated to both of the downstream attractors. Okay, so we've got a landscape here. We now want to parameterize that using the quantitative data we got from the flow cytometry. So we set out to do this, and this is work from Mary Sayers working with Hannah. And you can see here, we've got the experimental data. So our initial attempts to parameterize this model provided a pretty good correspondence to the data. We could emulate many of the features of the experimental data, but there was one key feature that this simple model couldn't recapitulate. So whatever we did to the parameterization, we always see both the floor plate and the neural progenitor attractor filling simultaneously. And of course that makes sense, right? So if you think about that, there's no way that this simple model could have, you could have an asynchronous filling of one attractor then another attractor. But that's what we were seeing in the experimental data. So this pointed to the possibility that that suggested that this landscape must be changing over time. And it suggested that there could be feedback emerging from initially committed floor plate cells that are then reshaping the landscape to push cells into neural precursor attractor. And we could implement that in the model and then rerun the simulations. And if we did that, we saw we could then get nice fits to the data. So initially, the unstable manifold is heading towards the floor plate attractor. As that fills, it pushes the unstable manifold towards the neural progenitor attractor. So this makes a prediction, right? This makes an experimental prediction that there's some signal emanating from floor plate progenitors, which is changing the allocation of cells coming out of that by that head attractor state. And to test this, what this suggests then is this would be influenced by the ability of cells to enter either the floor plate or the neural progenitor state. And we can test this with a chimeric experiment. If we mix wild-type cells, which can become either floor plate or neural progenitors, with FOXA2 knockout cells, which are restricted to neural identity, if fate allocation is cell autonomous, then wild-type cells should always make the same proportion of floor plate, regardless of the chimera composition. But if there is feedback, if it is regulative, then we would expect wild-type cells to make more floor plate when surrounded by FOXA2 mutant cells. So the higher the proportion of FOXA2 mutant cells, the more likely it is that a wild-type cell will make a floor plate, compensating for the deficit. So that's the experimental paradigm. We could run that using our model through simulations, and indeed, as you would expect, the higher the proportion of FOXA2 mutant cells in a simulation, the more likely it is that a wild-type cell will make a floor plate cell. So that's the simulations, that's the in silico prediction. Then we can actually run the experiment by making chimeras with different proportions of wild type and FOXA2 mutant cells, and we end up with a reasonably good fit to the predictions. So this is consistent with a signal emanating from floor plate cells, which is making cells more likely to become neural progenitors. So what's the molecular identity of that signal? So we could go back to our single cell transcriptome data and look at the combination of ligands and receptors expressed in floor plate and neural progenitors, which came up with a bunch of signals that could represent this regulative signal. We tested several by adding inhibitors during this process to these signals and asking what it did to the proportions of floor plate and neural progenitors. And what we found is that if we inhibited signals such as Wnt and FGF, we had no effect on the proportion of cell types. But if we inhibited BMP signaling, now we found a much higher proportion of cells being allocated to the floor plate and consequently a lower proportion being neural progenitors. So this suggests that BMP emanating from floor plate cells is pushing uncommitted cells to become neural progenitors, decreasing their probability of becoming floor plate. So then if we put this together, so I should say we also looked at retinoic acid, and while retinoic acid is important for this upper saddle for generating the initial head state, that progenitor that undergoes symmetry breaking, it doesn't affect the proportions of cells allocated to floor plate or neural progenitors. Whereas BMP signaling is determining the position of this bottom saddle, that the direction of that unstable manifold, the allocation of cells to these two attractors. So we have two signals here which are controlling different aspects of the landscape. So yeah, retinoic acid is initiating the symmetry breaking, then BMP signaling is regulating the allocation to the two outcomes. So this leaves one final set of experiments. So can we reconstruct this entirely synthetically? So I've told you that FOXA2 and PAX6 are necessary and sufficient for this symmetry breaking event when they're expressed in different cells. We wanted to ask the question, if we transiently co-express these in the same cell, so now if we make a cell line with doxycycline control of both FOXA2 and PAX6, is that sufficient in the absence of any retinoic acid to generate this symmetry breaking event? And the answer is that it is. So now if we generate artificially FOXA2 PAX6 co-expressing cells, remove the doxycycline to let this resolve, then we end up with nicely patterned neural tube organoids. Moreover, we can tune the allocation of cells to floor plate or neural in this preparation by regulating BMP signaling. By inhibiting BMP signaling, we increase the proportion of cells allocated to the floor plate. So now we can sort of reconstruct this artificially with regulation of two transcription factors and controlling one extrinsic signal. So I'm going to wrap up there. So I just want to say a couple of things in closing. So what I told you about today is a symmetry breaking event triggered by a pulse of retinoic acid. This results in the transient co-expression of PAX6 and FOXA2, which then resolves with the proportional allocation of cells to two alternative fates, and there's regulation of those, the allocation, the proportions of cells allocated to those two fates by BMP signaling. And the minimal requirements for this seem to be quite simple: two opposing transcription factors and one regulative feedback loop. And I think key to this is this dynamical landscape. And I think there are a couple of three features of this landscape which are sort of provide an explanation, provide an understanding of how this is working. The first is that PAX6 FOXA2 co-expressing state that in these landscapes is labeled as the head attractor. This is a shallow attractor which enables asynchronous differentiation. It means a population of cells is exiting that attractor at a constant rate. And that allows then regulative feedback from the early generated cells to the later committed cells. So an interesting aspect of that is that means that commitment to differentiate, leaving that head attractor, is actually occurring before specification, before the cells have committed to either one fate or the other fate. Depending on the signals they see during that differentiation, they will be allocated to one or the other. And yes, and that is generated by that regulative feedback there. So signals from downstream fate is then able to provide regulative feedback. And I don't think this is going to be unique to this particular system. So I've shown you neural tube organoids, which involves two transcription factors, FOXA2, PAX6, and the signal BMP. But we've seen very similar dynamical system behavior in neuromesodermal progenitors. It's different transcription factors, different signals, but the same landscape. Similarly, with the allocation of from inner cell mass to epiblast versus primitive ectoderm. Again, different transcription factors, different signals, but the same underlying mechanism. So I think we're going to see this repeatedly as we look at these regulative self-organizing systems. It provides a mechanistically simple way in which a system can become can break symmetry and regulate downstream proportions. Okay, I'm going to finish there. So this work has been led by Hannah Stewart with Mary Saez, and it's been a long-standing collaboration with Eli Tanaka in Vienna, together with Jinkui Kuei and Elena Constantini, and and my long-term dynamical systems collaborator, David Rand. Thanks for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.